your shame. You're a little heartbreaker and you seem proud of it. Breaking hearts right and left and you seem to just love it.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is If Molly Cassius with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, June 19th. The Manatee County Planning Commission is recommending denial of a proposed 131-home development near Rye and Waterline Roads near Parrish in East County. The planning commissioners unanimously voted against the Ivy Run project, despite changes by developer KB Homes that reduced the number of homes and added traffic improvements. Several commissioners cited ongoing safety and traffic concerns on Rye Road. The Manatee County Commission will make the final decision later this summer. KB Homes is based in Tampa. Florida still owes at least $603 million to companies involved in the state's immigration enforcement operations, according to a review of state contracts by the Florida Phoenix. The unpaid agreements include contracts for detention center operations, security services, and sanitation at migrant detention facilities, including the Everglades Detention Center, known as Alligator Alcatraz. The report found the state has paid less than half of its immigration-related contracts so far. The spending comes as Governor Ron DeSantis continues to defend the cost of the state's immigration crackdown, arguing it saves taxpayers money in the long run. The city of Sarasota is extending paid parking hours downtown beginning June 29th. Under the new schedule, on-street metered parking will run from 8 a.m. until midnight. City garages and parking lots will require payment 24 hours a day. Free parking will remain available on Sundays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at meters and from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. in city garages and lots. The city has been making a loss on its parking operations. If you are planning to contest your parking lot ticket today, do not. Rather, celebrate emancipation. The city of Sarasota is observing the Juneteenth holiday, with administrative offices closed. Garbage, recycling, and yard waste collection schedules are operating as normal. Several city facilities are running on modified holiday hours. Meanwhile, the city is co-sponsoring a Juneteenth celebration Saturday from 1 to 6 p.m. on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Way, featuring live music, food trucks, vendors, and family activities. This has been If Molly Cassius with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, June 19th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. It seems the 39th or 40th time is the charm when it comes to arranging a peace settlement with Iran, or at least by CNN's count, that was the number of times the orange menace from Palm Beach promised one was days away. This time, a memorandum of understanding has been somewhat agreed upon by both sides, with lots of points that still need to be worked out. The agreement, designed to pave the way for these meetings, seems to cede almost all U.S. leverage and hands Iran billions of dollars in revenue up front by waiving sanctions. It may therefore dent Trump's self-conjuring mystique as the world's greatest dealmaker, which lifted him from reality TV to the White House. at the risk of making a dead horse scream from being beaten. This deal is far worse for the U.S. and its allies than the deal negotiated by Barack Obama and his administration, which reached better results with no blood lost. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Jada Wright Green, Executive Director of Minnesota ASALA, on today's Juneteenth celebration, who updates us on the Freedom School offered by ASALA and why during these days of political distortion of our history, particularly the real history of our black citizens, needs to be told. But first, hear the latest way this administration is attempting to eliminate the Department of Education without congressional approval. The Trump administration announced this week plans to move two major functions of the Education Department to other parts of the government, and the most aggressive moves yet by the White House to dismantle an agency it has pledged to dissolve. The changes move programs for disabled students into the Health and Human Services Department and enforcement of civil rights laws in schools to the Justice Department. Administration officials said the changes would improve government efficiency and lead to better results for students. Eliminating the Education Department requires an act of Congress, and disability groups have argued that so does moving the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services. The office oversees $15 billion a year in funding for students with disabilities and enforces compliance with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The Education Department will also shift duties for its Office of Civil Rights, which for decades has enforced anti-discrimination laws in schools, to the Justice Department. In recent years, the largest share of complaints about discrimination in schools have been filed on behalf of disabled students. The changes appeared to decouple the administration of services for students with disabilities from enforcement of civil rights protections of those same students. The changes were expected to be challenged in court immediately as part of a continuing lawsuit that the Coalition of Democratic Attorneys General first filed last year over the administration's attempts to dismantle the Education Department. The American Federation of Government Employees, Local 252, which represents about 2,000 current and former Education Department workers, immediately criticized the announcement, describing the move as part of the Trump administration's attempt to unlawfully dismantle the Education Department. This will leave our most vulnerable students and families who have been shut out of our education system without the services they need and protection when they face discrimination, said Rachel Gittleman, president of AFGE Local 252. This isn't efficiency, it's chaos. Education Department officials said students, parents, and educators would not experience any change in services, but additional details were not immediately available. These agreements align federal responsibilities with the agency's best position to support them, strengthening the effectiveness and impact of critical services, Linda McMahon, the education secretary, said in a statement. The Education Department's Office for Civil Rights, which has a budget of $140 million, will now refer all civil rights complaints to the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, according to an agreement between the departments. The Justice Department has lost more than 20% of its nearly 13,000 lawyers it had at the start of the second Trump administration, which some have attributed to political pressure inside the department. Both Republicans and Democrats in Congress have raised concerns to Ms. McMahon about growing backlog of civil rights complaints in schools. In response, Ms. McMahon told lawmakers last month that she wanted to hire more civil rights lawyers at the Education Department, despite a budget request from the White House to reduce funding for that office. Advocacy groups argued that by moving the offices for special education and civil rights, the Trump administration was effectively weakening oversight after already drastically reducing staffing in those areas. Moving special education to health and human services risks treating disabilities as medical conditions rather than protecting students' legal right to a free and appropriate public education, said Kerry Rodriguez, the president of the National Parents Union, in a written statement. Shifting civil rights enforcement to the Justice Department turns parents seeking support into potential litigants. Families didn't ask for lawsuits. They asked for their children to be educated. In Florida, the state is trying another way to give away public school land to private schools. The big story? Florida has a new law that some education advocates have suggested is a gateway to a public school land grab. Public education supporters raised yellow flags of caution early in the 2026 session when they saw the legislation SB 84, which initially would have required school districts to give undeveloped taxpayer-owned property to private interests. Several feared that the measure's provisions would have forced any district that had lost enrollment in three consecutive years to offer undeveloped land owned longer than 3 years to charter school operators. Coming so soon after lawmakers allowed Schools of Hope charters to claim unused space on campuses, concerns swirled that the state aimed to erode the system that more than three-quarters of families rely on for schooling. Bill sponsors later backed off the early language, eliminating all references to charter schools and instead focusing on an inventory of the property rather than creating a plan for giving it away. Governor Ron DeSantis signed that version of the law last week. Observers have said they still worry that the original intent remains in the offing, but at least for now, the immediacy is gone. Watch for the next steps next year. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WVPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. An intersex teacher forced to resign is suing the state. Shepard Scalf, a Florida teacher who is intersex, is alleging in a new Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filing that his school district fired him because they perceived him as transgender. Scalf was assigned female at birth but identifies as male per the Monday filing. The filing, Scalf claims that at the same time he was fired, he was told his performance as language arts teacher at Patriot Oaks Academy in St. Johns County School District was exemplary, and that there was no merits-based justification for his termination. Scalf taught sixth grade and has been newly hired for the 2025-2026 school year. At the same time, the district knew both that I had a male gender identity, they gave me a placard saying Mr. Scalf, and that I was assigned female at birth based on my employment paperwork, Scalf wrote. I therefore believe this termination was based on the perception that I'm transgender. Just 3 weeks into the school year, Principal Drew Chiodo allegedly called Scalf in for an emergency meeting held on August 29, 2025, per the filing. Scalf says he attended the meeting with a representative from the teachers union. At the meeting, Chiodo allegedly read a letter from Superintendent Brendan Asplund. Per the filing, the letter from Asplund claimed that due to Scalf being a first-year teacher, his employment was probationary and could be dismissed without cause. The letter said he would be placed on temporary leave following a board meeting. Scalf says he was given the choice to accept the probationary release or voluntarily resign. Scalf resigned after being told by the union rep that a resignation would be better for his future career prospects than a termination, according to the EEOC filing. Receiving this ultimatum was confusing and overwhelming. Everything had been going so well. I couldn't understand why this was happening, Scalf told the ACLU. The start of the school year is always brimming with promise and excitement, and I was looking forward to continuing my teaching career at Patriot Oaks. Until I was cornered into resigning and it became clear to me that being fired had nothing to do with my qualifications or teaching. It is about who I am. After his resignation, Scalf says he received evidence that his termination was due to a parent complaining that he was transgender per the filing. The ACLU is arguing that St. John's County School District violated Scalf's civil rights under Title VII, which was interpreted to include LGBTQ plus people through the 2020 Supreme Court case, Bostock versus Clayton County. Intersex is an umbrella term that refers to people who carry variations in their reproductive and sexual anatomy that differ from what is traditionally considered male or female. For example, an intersex person could have one set of genitalia internally and another externally, while also having different sets of chromosomes. Some people can have ambiguous genitalia and may not know that they are intersex at birth. While the medical diagnosis has always been in use since the early 1900s, intersex advocates pushed in 1970s to have the status be recognized as an identity in a community rather than strictly a medical classification. Like any other worker, an intersex employee's talents and contributions should be what counts, not others' biased beliefs about who counts as male and female. Sylvian Fraser Anthony, legal and policy director at Interact, an intersex advocacy group, told the ACLU. Intersex employees like Mr. Scalf deserve to be valued and respected at work, and they are equally entitled to the protections of Title VII. Punishing someone because of a variation in their sex characteristics or perceived nonconformity with the sex they were assigned at birth is plainly impermissible, and employers must understand that these forms of sexual discrimination will have consequences. When contracted by them, Christian H. Upchurch, Executive Director for Community Relations at St. John's County School District, wrote, "We will not comment on pending litigation." LGBTQ plus groups fear this year may be the end of Pride celebrations. In Wilton Manors, where rainbow flags adorn every other business and many homes, locals are getting ready for the LGBTQ plus Pride Festival on June 20th with an estimated crowd of at least 50,000. This, though, will be the last year the Broward County City can provide $50,000 to the annual Stonewall Pride Parade and Street Festival because of new Florida law passed under Governor Ron DeSantis. SB 1134 banned any municipal support for diversity, equity, and inclusion in programs or events. So after this summer, Wilton Manors officials will no longer be able to ride atop a float in its glow night parade, according to City Commissioner Paul Raleigh. "We are a target. Wilton Manors is a target for Tallahassee," he said. "They'd love for us to make a misstep and pull somebody out. They could pull out one commissioner out and they could pull everybody. SB 1134 establishes aggressive enforcement, allowing individual citizens to sue and be awarded legal fees and damages from local elected officials. It allows for the removal of elected officials by explicitly labeling a DEI funding vote as malfeasance or misfeasance. The Wilton Manors Commission has discussed putting a ballot measure in front of residents to allow for local control and filling any vacancies. The new law doesn't go into effect until 2027, but municipalities are getting ready heading into budget season. Key West, which also held its festival earlier this month, was notified by Monroe County that $75,000 will be canceled in the next fiscal year. Equality Florida, the state's largest civil rights advocacy organization, is advising municipalities of hard-earned carve-outs from SB 1134, such as allowing permitting of local events, police and public safety support for such events, and support for public health programs, such as HIV outreach. "Still, the chilling effect has been pretty pronounced," said John Harris Maurer, Equality Florida's public policy director. The law was intentionally written with broad and vague terms to cast a wide net, Maurer said. Local governments are considering pre-compliance because of the vague language and the very draconian penalties. The wide net catches much more than just the LGBTQ plus community, but anything or anyone that appears to support diversity, equality, and inclusion. The disfavored groups, number one, obviously, would be white males, and I think they've been discriminated against, DeSantis said in April when he signed the bill. Still, for the LGBTQ community, the NDEI law is just another example of how Florida has become increasingly inhospitable for an estimated 900,000 people, of 900,000 of its residents. DeSantis had his Department of Transportation paint over rainbow intersections and crosswalks, including one in front of the Pulse Shooting Memorial in Orlando, under the guise of traffic safety. He and his Republican-led legislature have targeted literature pronouns, driver's license, gender markers, gender-affirming care, and free speech of teachers. Randy Hulk, founder of the Palm Beach County Human Rights Council, said there are numerous community programs that rely on their local municipality in some way, possibly not even monetarily, and that could be affected. And fear permeates many municipalities. In Delray Beach, for example, the city's lobbyist warned elected leaders that if they supported a pride festival by contributing $15,000, Tallahassee could take away funding for infrastructure projects. What they should say is, I'm here to represent my constituents. They have enjoyed these festivals for years. It brings money to our community and brings recognition to our community, he said. These events are a boon to the city, said Rowley, the Wilton Manors commissioner. Wilton estimates its one-day street festival generates over $6 million in direct economic impact. Across the state, in St. Petersburg, the city estimates its Pride Festival on the last weekend of June generates $60.7 million. A congressional candidate wants to know who owns that giant Confederate flag drivers can see from I-75. A Florida congressional candidate wants to release identifying information for individuals behind the massive Confederate flag near the Interstate 4, Interstate 75 interchange in Hillsborough County. Mark Davis, a veteran and business owner who qualified to run in Florida's 16th congressional district, says no party candidate took to Facebook to denounce the flag and those who maintain it. Just got back from Tallahassee after officially getting on the ballot, and one of the first things I see is that giant Confederate flag towering over a Florida highway, Davis wrote. The sons of the Confederate veterans and everyone still defending that symbol. I want your blanking addresses. After the original post prompted over 14,000 comments, Davis doubled down with another post in which he demanded that the flag be taken down within 30 days, or he would dox the living FNS out of the people responsible for that flag. Doxing is the practice of publicly revealing someone's personal information online, such as their name, address, and phone number. The Sons of Federal Veterans did not respond to a request for comment as of press time. Davis told Florida Politics he wants U.S. to approach the Confederate flag the way Germany has dealt with Nazi symbols. Germany has adopted strict laws banning glorification of the Nazi regime and a display of Nazi symbols. Asked whether the Sons of the Confederate Veterans have a First Amendment right to fly the flag on their private property, Davis countered that he has rights too. I got First Amendment rights too, and I'm going to use them to the extent of my ability, Davis said. My goal is just to call them out, right, and shame them publicly. Davis did not clarify what information he planned to post publicly, but said that he had obtained the Sons of Confederate Veterans organizational chart and planned to start at the top and work my way down. The 60-foot by 30-foot Confederate battle flag was first raised over Confederate Memorial Park in Hillsborough County on June 14, 2008, which is Flag Day. The park and the flag are founded by and maintained by the Sons of Confederate Veterans, an organization made up of descendants of Confederate soldiers. In 2020, the flag was briefly taken down in the wake of George Floyd's death when social media users threatened to burn it, but was later reinstalled. The flag is not located in CD 16, which includes parts of St. Petersburg, Bradenton, and Manatee County. In addition to Davis, three Republicans and five Democrats are running in CD 16 to succeed retiring 20-year Republican U.S. Rep. Vern Buchanan, who announced in January he wants to pass the torch. Former Epstein aide testifies to Congress about payoffs. Sarah Kellen, a longtime personal assistant to sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, has disclosed for the first time that Epstein's preferential treatment at the Palm Beach County Jail may have been the result of him paying off Palm Beach sheriff's deputies. Kellen, during her interview with the House Oversight Committee last month, was questioned about perks that Epstein received while he was incarcerated at the Palm Beach County Stockade, a facility where Epstein was jailed from 2008 to 2009. She said she visited Epstein several times in jail, and one time when she was home, he was able to use Skype from a jail computer to contact her. He used that computer to get her to undress for him on camera while he was in the jail, Kellen testified. She was then asked by Florida Congressman Max Frost, Democrat representing the Orlando area, whether she knew of any other ways that Epstein was able to receive special treatment in jail. I know that he arranged to have cash and the like Disneyland tickets taken to one of the officers in the jail, and I'm not sure what he received with that, Kellen replied, according to a transcript of her testimony. She identified Palm Beach Sheriff's Deputy Michael Fox. She was asked how she learned about Fox, and she explained that Epstein's paralegal, Story Cowles, had complained to her that he had to drive a long distance to personally deliver the cash and tickets from Epstein. The Miami Herald was unsuccessful in reaching Fox. A spokeswoman for the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office said Fox retired from the agency in 2020. The Epstein investigation did not reveal these allegations, and they were never investigated in connection with the case, said Palm Beach Sheriff's Office spokesperson Teresa Barbara. She further noted that an investigation by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement conducted in 2021 found no wrongdoing by members of the sheriff's office. After an extensive investigation, FDLE determined that there was no inappropriate or criminal behavior on the part of a Palm Beach SO member with respect to their participation in Epstein's work release or permit detail. She added that there are no current plans to investigate any other allegations since FDLE's 2021 probe. The investigation is complete, she said. Allowed to leave jail up to 12 hours a day, questions have long been raised about how Epstein was able to receive work release, where he could leave jail for up to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, to visit his office as a known sex predator. Palm Beach Sheriff Rick Bradshaw, who had been the county sheriff for more than 40 years, has said under the work release requirements at the time, Epstein was eligible for the program. Palm Beach Sheriff Rick Bradshaw said Epstein qualified for the program at the time. The Palm Beach County Stockade, where Epstein was jailed from 2008 to 2009 after pleading guilty to two solicitation charges in state court in West Palm Beach. Former deputy Michael Gower, who supervised the jail during Epstein's tenure, said Epstein was given game time, a reduced sentence for good behavior, and to his knowledge was not given any special treatment by deputies. Epstein paid for overtime for some 90 sheriff's deputies during his work release, totaling about $130,000. Epstein's business, the Florida Science Foundation, paid the money to PBSO to cover the deputies assigned overtime to monitor him during his work release. The deputies were asked to wear suits and refer to Epstein as their client, PBSO records show. Gower said because he was mindful that Epstein was slick, he rotated the jail deputies frequently to prevent any one deputy from being influenced by Epstein. Sheriff's officials had lunch and dinner with Epstein. Gower admitted that Epstein was able to persuade him to meet for lunch, to come to his mansion for dinner, and was released from jail in July 2009. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my interview with Jada Wright Green, Executive Director of Minnesota ASALA.
I'm Lou Lorenian. I'm happy to welcome Jada Wright Green, First Executive Director of the local branch of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, Minnesota ASALA, a national organization founded by the father of Black History Month, Dr. Carter G. Woodson. Good morning. How you doing, Jada?
I'm great. How are you doing this morning?
You know, thanks a lot for coming on. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to Minnesota ASALA.
Sure. I'm originally from Jacksonville, Florida, where I was raised, attended Bethune-Cookman University, went on to grab a few master's degrees, including one in history, and finally decided that public history was what I wanted to do. And so I'm a public historian. Also have been working in the nonprofit field for over 20 years. I'm very dedicated to history and, you know, nonprofit and philanthropy. And so all three of those things kind of merged. And in August 2024, I was hired as the first executive director of Minnesota ASALA.
That's great. You know, I know we're recording this interview, on the week of Juneteenth, but it is going to be aired on Juneteenth, which is a national holiday, but that was not always so. Please tell listeners who may not know what the celebration is, and after we get done with that, you can tell us a little bit about how the current administration has tried to weaken its effect.
Yes. So Juneteenth, let me say this, it's so important because it really marks the moment that freedom was finally reached for every enslaved Black person in the United States. So not just on paper, but just in reality. So even though we had the Emancipation Proclamation that was made effective in 1863, it could not still be implemented in places that were still under Confederate control. So as a result, in like the westernmost part of Confederate state of Texas, you still had enslaved people who would not be free until much later. So freedom finally came on June 19th, 1865, when about 2,000 Union troops arrived in Galveston Bay, Texas, and the Army announced that more than 250,000 enslaved Black people in the state were free by that executive decree. So this became known as Juneteenth by newly free Black people in Texas. That day is just commemorated again on June 19th when General George Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas. And that was an order that was given, General Order Number 3, and just reinforcing it. Now, I want to remind everyone, this is 2.5 years after it was issued. So pretty remarkable that, you know, it took such a long time for that to come about. But important that we just celebrate the freedom of those enslaved individuals, and not just our Black people, but everyone. This is a celebration of freedom for all.
Yeah, you know, and that is, and I'm glad you brought up that that 2.5 years, because that's 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, I'm assuming you're referring to, was signed.
Yes.
You know, that,
yes.
that federally freed all the slaves. And, you know, I think people need to realize that if you had been enslaved, you know, 2.5 years is an awful long time to wait for your freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Something
mm-hmm.
you probably went to bed, you know, dreaming about, or every day of your life, you know.
Right.
So, yes, I do understand that that's important. Now, you know, Juneteenth, I know Joe Biden made Juneteenth a federal holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is a federal holiday. And the new guy, you know, sort of acknowledges it. But there were some other things that changed. Like for instance, you know, I thought the parks had a program or a policy on Juneteenth where people get in for free. But that's not true anymore, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's these almost targeted ways to kind of diminish or almost hide what that is. And sometimes people are very shameful of the truth and history. And to me, it's so important for healing across the nation and across people that we acknowledge that this happened. No one's saying that, you know, you have to, we're not trying to make people pay for what they've done, but what has been done by our ancestors and people that came before us. But let's acknowledge so that we can heal from what transpired years ago. It's just so important that we acknowledge our history. And I don't want people to think it is Black history, but it's also society's history. It's a part of the fabric of the United States.
Oh, it's an incredible part of the fabric of the United States. And anybody that denies that, you know, the slave labor did not help build this country into what it's mm-hmm. become I don't know, blind,
yeah.
Idiot, all kinds of derogatory things can be said because it's pretty obvious. You know, now as you made clear, you know, in your intro, you know, you do have a nice background in history, which is kind of important these days when it, especially as we just started to talk about the history of this nation, particularly regarding the place Black people have played, has become controversial. Is mm-hmm. that one reason? Is that just one reason why you know, the Freedom School at Minnesota, Osala, is so important? Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Freedom School is important because it fulfills the mission of our organization and the legacy that Carter G. Woodson left for us to carry out. It's also important because of the impact it delivers, and it provides empowerment. It shares accurate, fact-based knowledge about Black history. Our students are becoming leaders. They're becoming more confident in who they are. They are learning, even helping with their literacy skills, although it's kind of difficult for us to measure because sometimes we only have them for a short amount of time. But that time we have them, it's so impactful. The students are walking away understanding who they are, being confident as an individual, being confident as a leader, and moving on and going home to their parents and saying, look what I learned. And so we've had classes where the students will talk so much about what they learned that they go back and tell their parents, and their parents are like, hey, what about us? We want to learn too. And so we've had adult classes in the past where, you know, parents would come drop their students off, but they wouldn't leave. And we said, we got to do something for them, too. And so we're doing things, you know, on that level. Also, we encourage people to become members of Osala because we have every meeting that we have a moment in history where we share about Black history or history in general, and focusing in sometimes on Florida history because a lot of course, individuals in Sarasota are here, retirees, or just want to learn more. But it's just so important that we continue Freedom School because it's more important in a moment where there are deliberate acts to stop sharing truthful history. And so it's just imperative that we are mission aligned and we follow the charge that Carter G. Woodson left for us.
Yeah, that was another point that I wanted to bring out that I think is kind of important, you know, in these days when, you know, particularly here in Florida, you know, parts of our history, you know, aren't being taught or are being, you know, sort of soft-sold. And you know, like, you know, I know for a fact, I mean, a good friend of mine, you know, who's an educated guy, but he had never heard of the Tulsa Massacre until, you know, a few years ago when that got to the forefront of the news, you know, because the current president had, you know, a tasteless rally there at one point, you know, and that got in the news and everybody found out about it. But, you know, there's a lot of things that have happened, you know, in the past that are, you know, incredibly important, you know, in shaping, you know, the place of black immigrants to this country. And they are, in fact, immigrants, even though...
Absolutely. We think about, too, in Florida, there were a lot of things that happened. But what I found through research and my own publication is that there were individuals in Florida that not only built wealth for themselves by providing services that would have otherwise not been available, they made opportunities available for other black people. So you have individuals like in St. Augustine, Frank Butler, who started a grocery store. He also sold real estate and bought property and made it available for black people and affordable for them to own. Same thing with Garfield Rogers, who was based out of Manatee County, and he did work in Tampa, opened a life insurance company, but did the same thing, bought property in Tampa and provided affordable real estate to black people. You know, so these are just two individuals. There's countless others that in the state of Florida that said, hey, you know what, there may not be opportunities across the board, so how can I as an individual make it available for others that are like me?
Yeah, it's important to learn about that. You know, I'm curious, is Butler Boulevard in Jacksonville, is that named after this Frank Butler?
You know what? It was not.
It was not.
Yeah,
I just go up there a lot because my son went to UNF and he's living in Jacksonville.
Okay.
So I know Jacksonville. Yes. So I've learned about Jacksonville. But, yeah, so Butler Boulevard is not named after that Frank.
No, it's not. I think it's John T. Butler that is named after. We used to call it I think it was JTB when I was growing up.
Yeah, okay. So has the Freedom School grown? I mean, I know you've only been there since 2024, but, I mean, you must know, you know, it's been around for, I think, at least 3 or 4 years, because I interviewed David Wilkins when the first year that it started.
Yes, David Wilkins, who we call our founder or framer of Freedom School, because we had this charge from the National ASALA office. As you know, ASALA was founded in 1915 by Carter G. Woodson, and there are branches or chapters across the United States. And the Minnesota, of course, Manatee and Sarasota counties combined, is the largest of the 50 branches in the United States and the most active. And so there was his charge to implement Freedom Schools, and David Wilkins, along with Edna Sherrill, who's actually the current program director, and Jennifer Joseph, who started the Freedom School in Sarasota. It has grown tremendously. It started out with our partners, in the Betty J. Thompson Library. We've also partnered with Girls Inc. And now we have expanded and we're doing these mobile classes because we're finding that when we go to sites, we can reach more students. And so right now we have classes this summer, what we call our Mobile Freedom School. We have 6 sites across Sarasota and Manatee County, one of them in Newtown at the Leonard Reed House. We'd love to partner with them. Also, as far as Manatee County, at the 13th Ave Dream Center, also the Palmetto Youth Center, the Boys and Girls Club in Palmetto, and DeSoto, and the Sarasota Housing Authority. So we have expanded tremendously from just a Saturday-based program to now a Freedom School mobile and going to sites. And so initially, again, we started on Saturdays, and now we're after school. Of course, school is out, and so now the summertime, which we typically have loads of students. Last year, we reached almost 100 students, and again, I'm always trying to reach for as many students as possible, so the goal is to reach 100, if not more.
Okay, great. You know, I just want to interrupt for a second for listeners just tuning in. This is WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Jada Wright Green, who is the executive director of Minnesota ASALA. I'm just curious about, I don't know, probably they do. Do these lessons in the Freedom School, do they refute the way some people in power these days are claiming we are a post-racial America, and that all those efforts to level the playing field for voters somehow discriminates against white people?
You know, it's funny you speak about that, because I start thinking about, you know, the Voting Rights Act, and when people start arguing that it's outdated, you know, they are ignoring any race and the historical acts of discrimination that made those protections necessary. Because you have to think, when the Voting Rights Act of 1965 happened, it was a response to the documented widespread state-sanctioned suppression of black voters. Some of those things included literacy taxes, poll taxes, grandfather clauses. There was violence, intimidation, you know, closing those polling places in black communities. So these weren't isolated acts. These were systematic, coordinated acts to stop black people from voting. So when people are arguing, saying that that's not happening, oh, it is happening. And we can't erase history. You know, that's the reason why we are here, to share our history and to disseminate and research, protect history. And so it's still happening, and it's important that we continue the legacy of Carter G. Woodson and do things to protect them.
Yeah, that's you know, it seemed like after the murder, the horrific murder of George Floyd, you know, mm-hmm. You know, race relations in this country were starting to take a step forward with the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, which actually sort of started, you know, or sort of, I guess, started in Missouri when I can't think of his name right now, was murdered. But I mean, it's not like George Floyd was like the first black man to be killed, unarmed black man to be killed wantonly by police,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that was the one that seemed to click, okay?
Yes.
You know, and it did cause some changes. I mean, companies changing policies, federal government changing policies, but now all of a sudden, you know, that's DEI, and that's woke, and that's all going away. I mean, are we talking about that in the Freedom School, I guess?
We are. And, you know, Freedom School was started during the Civil Rights Movement in order to teach our children and families how to survive in society with what was happening during the Civil Rights Movement. And guess what? It's happening again. So now, it's our charge to do that, you know, because those things are happening. There are black men that are dying at the hands of violent acts, and women. So it's so important that we continue this fight and that we tell our stories and we inform our children. I want people to understand this is not against anyone. It's empowering these students because they don't always see, the beauty in themselves or the beauty in being empowered and being a leader. And just telling them truthful, accurate history that's been documented. That is what we have been charged to do and what we're doing. So that's what we're trying to do. We're not saying that, oh, well, you can't love people. You can love everyone, but understand who you are as an individual and be able to embrace that and be a leader and a productive citizen in society.
Yeah, you know, it always strikes me that it's not a zero sum game. You know, just because you treat black people fairly doesn't mean white people aren't being treated fairly.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's just, and there has been, you know, such a distortion, you know, in the balance of power. You know, I always find this like incredibly ironic, you know, because I thought it was one of the greatest things that ever happened, was the election of Barack Obama. Is this animosity towards Black Americans? I mean, did it all start with that? Is this like kind of a backlash by some folks?
I think it can be seen as that, and we don't know, but I can only imagine the amount of threats to his life, his family's life, just from being in the White House, because the reality is there are people out here that, you know, hate people of a different race, of a different nationality, of a different religion, of a different belief. And so I can imagine that, you know, that may be part of, but I want people to understand, you know, when Freedom School was happening in the summertime, there was not just black people, there were white people. We had allies in the fight during the civil rights movement. And I'm grateful because we still have allies today that are helping, you know, us continue to do the work that we're doing and not just alone in this. Because it's not going to just take, you know, our voices. It has to be a collective voice. And so I'm thrilled to know that that part of history did repeat itself, for sure.
Yeah, you know, and as far as Barack Obama goes, I know, I was a huge supporter of Barack Obama, not mm-hmm. because he was black, but because he was just a really smart guy, and he had great
yes.
policies, and he proved
yes.
it when he was president. You know?
Well, and an all-around good guy. I mean, I just watched recently he was doing this commercial or something, and I guess this basketball player, they've been having this kind of banter because he's a, you know, basketball player or whatever. But when you see him, you know, because sometimes we have this, we put people, especially our presidents, on this pedestal, they're not humanized or can be seen as, you know, just people, and I feel like he's done that. I love the fact that, you know, the Obama administration opened up the White House and said, this is the people's house. And you constantly saw individuals go to the White House for different visits and to be a place of openness. It was just a great time, and I think in our country where we were, like you said, starting to heal, and we were united in a lot of ways, and people were more harmony among one another, as opposed to what we see now. Sometimes it's just hate, and it's very sad that it has come to that.
It is very sad, and for people to accuse, you know, Barack Obama of being the most divisive president, I think, is just really off base. You know,
yes.
because I agree with you. If anything, he brought people together. He brought
mm-hmm.
us all together to understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now as this is winding down, I do have to ask. You know, we are obviously in election season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people are trying really hard to prevent black voices from being heard. You know, through redistricting and gerrymandering and changing the rules about drop box voting and et cetera, et cetera. What are the feelings in this upcoming election do you see in the black community? Are people going to fight back? Are they definitely going to vote?
Absolutely. We will be rallying. We will be proactive. We will be fighting for our rights. You know, I tell my children, people died for the opportunity for myself and my husband to go and vote. My oldest child will be 18 this year, and my gift to her will be a voter registration card. And I say that as not only a black female that's a leader in the nonprofit industry, but a Florida girl that had a grandmother who taught me the importance of history and who I was as a person that is a public historian, who my favorite time period is the civil rights movement, just the strength of people during that time. I go and make sure my children and my daughter, the best gift I can give her is that voter registration card to be able to go and vote and voice her opinion. And so we as parents have literally stood in line, I think, when we voted in the election for Barack Obama. We took our children with us so they could see it. So it's so important that we give our children that. And in our community, we will be out, we will be voting, we will be rallying, we will be there, we will make sure our voice is heard, because we're going to continue the fight just like they fought during the civil rights movement. We will be doing it today in 2026.
And on that note, you know, I really want to thank you, Jada Wright Green, Executive Director of Minnesota ASALA, you know, for making time for us today. Is there anything else, you know, you want to tell my listeners, like, for instance, how they can learn more about Minnesota ASALA and the great work you guys are doing?
Absolutely. Well, first I want to say thank you to the Sarasota community for just supporting Minnesota ASALA and what we're doing. I have grown to just love this community, very open, very giving, very just community-based. I thank you all for embracing me, from being from Jacksonville, Florida, and not being from Sarasota. The people here are just absolutely wonderful. And to say that you can find out more about us at our website, ASALA-MinnesotaFL.org. You can donate to our cause there. If you go to our website, the first thing you see is to donate to Freedom School. We are getting ready to gear up upcoming in the fall. We have our Freedom School fundraiser where we're going to raise money to continue Freedom School to grow and expand. We want to be able to take our students to, you know, do some experiential learning and taking them throughout the state of Florida. We want to do some financial literacy classes. So we're asking individuals to come out and come to our Freedom School event. It will be October 25th, 2026. It will feature Wycliffe Gordon, jazz trombonist, and West Coast Back Theater Troupe. It is made possible through the Community Foundation of Sarasota, the Marilyn Harwell Fund, which is administered by Karen Lobo. We're excited for her support in ensuring that we're continuing Freedom School. So please check that out on October 25th and go to our website, ASALA-MinnesotaFL.org.
Hey, thanks again, Jada. And you can be sure those of us on WSLR will remind people as we get closer to that October 26th date that that event is happening.
Surging gas prices have pushed Americans to dig deeper into their wallets, skip purchases, and pull back on savings. President Donald Trump has dismissed America's economic concerns amid the Iran war as peanuts compared to the threat of Iran having a nuclear weapon. But the workers, the higher costs are hardly peanuts, with the price of gas surging about 50% since the war began. Plus, inflation has spread to many other items throughout the economy. Economists caution that energy prices are unlikely to drop quickly, despite the preliminary deal between the U.S. and Iran. For 38 gallons of regular gas, the average cost was about $113.32 at the end of February. Now, it's $154.47. That's a difference of $41.15. We didn't have the right data to definitely say how many peanuts you could have bought. But with that extra money you're spending on gas this week, you could have purchased the makings of a good breakfast. With the price of eggs and coffee easing somewhat, you could have bought 6 pounds of sliced bacon or 19 dozen large white grade A chicken eggs or 4 pounds of ground coffee in a can or plastic container. 27 pounds of fresh navel oranges. The fixings for a picnic. Tomatoes have also gone up in price this year because of crop issues, tariffs, and increased costs of diesel to transport the fruit. Still, You could have picked up 17 pounds of fresh field-grown tomatoes or 7 pounds of cheddar cheese or 22 pounds of prepackaged white bread or 21 pounds of iceberg lettuce or 64 pounds of bananas. The essentials of a good barbecue. Beef prices have spiked over the past year as demand remains strong and ranchers deal with smaller cattle herds. Yet, with your gas money, you could have purchased 10 pounds of boneless, skinless chicken breasts or 3 pounds of boneless sirloin steaks, USDA choice, or 6 pounds of uncooked ground beef or 72 cans of 12 ounce cans of soft drinks. And sweets to end the day? Most everybody likes a sweet treat, but some families skip such luxuries when money get tight. The extra money you spent on gas could have bought you 3 gallons of prepackaged ice cream, 8 pounds of chocolate chip cookies, or 3 liters of red, white, or rosé wine. You're listening to WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota.